Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another episode of The Interviews, the show that rounds up our chats with the cream of the cinematic crop. Fuse, with a Z, is the latest film by David Mackenzie, also with a Z, the British filmmaker behind the likes of Young Adam, Hell or High Water, The Outlaw King, and last year's thriller, Relay. He's staying firmly in high concept thriller territory with Fuse, which follows an army bomb disposal expert played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, as he tries to defuse an unexploded World War II bomb found on a London building site. And a gang of thieves led by Theo James, who use the chaos engineered by the bomb to attempt to pull off an audacious heist. And when James came into the pod booth recently, I jumped at the chance to speak to him. The English actor has been consistently impressive over the years in the likes of the Divergent movies, The Gentlemen, the second season of The White Lotus, and The Monkey. And I asked him about some of those, as well as Fuse, which is an interesting film and that is very hard to talk about without going into spoiler territory. It also gives us very little information or backstory, intentionally, about his character, Corrales. So bear that in mind as you listen to this interview. So here you go, Theo James talking about Fuse, which is in cinemas as of tomorrow. Enjoy.
Theo James, star of Fuse, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no. Pleasure to have you here. And this is a strange film to talk about. It's a cracking thriller, but it is so twisty and turny that I'm worried we may not be able to talk about it at all.
Or even, yeah. It's a kind of film about deception in many ways. David Mackenzie, the director, always liked the idea of doing something hard-boiled, which is, you know, a genre of kind of tough on the outside, a little softer on the inside. That's where the phrase comes from, obviously, I'm sure you know. Like a hard-boiled egg, like my face.
Yes, your face famously like a hard-boiled egg. People say that about you. That's all they say.
But yeah, he kind of had a concept. And then they had a script, but David really wanted to work on it and mold it and change it. So it evolved. The essential plot lines remained intact, but many of the detail changed and evolved as we were doing it. Where the characters from, how they reacted, what kind of people they were.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So when you started, how locked in was your character and your accent as well?
Not very locked in. That was kind of David and I. You know, his original version of him was a little unclear, and I wanted to just make him as fully rounded as he can be in a movie where it's about unknowable people, in a way.
Absolutely, yeah.
I liked the idea of, I mean, there's the Blood Diamond thing, obviously, but there are these guys who, these South African guys who've been in the military, then they kind of leave the military and are brought into nefarious kind of grey areas of morality and then get start getting sucked into even darker areas of morality.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of that, the diamond heist mixed with someone who had experience. It just felt real to me. Plus, you know, for me, accents are quite useful. They really ground a character. And I really like the kind of specificity of South African. It's kind of punk. It's kind of percussive. It's quite confident, but then there's something charming about it at the same time. It feels kind of weirdly international to me, which sounds like a stupid thing to say, but but yeah, that was kind of the beginning of the process.
And I love that you can still drop into it, because I imagine some actors, when they have an accent, they just dispose of it and they don't necessarily have it in the toolkit again. Or
yeah, it's funny, some are like that and then some really stick forever. It's a bit like those plays I did when I was, you know, 20.
Yeah.
And, you know, pieces of monologue will still be in my head, whereas, you know, most films I've ever done evaporate into the oblivion. So, yeah, it's funny.
What did you do when you were 20? What plays did you do back then? What's sticking in your head right now?
Back then, I was at Nottingham University doing an undergrad in philosophy, and there was a great, it was called the New Theatre. It was like a theatre run by students, and you kind of got to put on almost anything you like. But I remember doing Patrick Marber's Closer.
Oh, my God.
And
right.
And it's a good You know, I'm sure if I watched it now, I'm sure I'd be vomiting with cringe. But I just remember thinking I enjoyed its kind of complexities and the you know, the moral inexactitude of all these characters. And I think that's what I find interesting in this film. You know, these people, Sam's character, certainly, and Aaron's character, you know, there's no black or white. These are kind of likable-ish people, but also people with fairly lucid morality, should we say.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about it was that sort of that elusive quality about it as well. Your character Corrales and you know, Aaron's Taylor, because he is very well tailored in this.
He is.
Aaron's character, like, we are not given a lot of backstory, we're not given a lot of information. It, you know, things are doled out in pieces. So you have to kind of latch on to characters and really not knowing a lot about them. And I thought it was fascinating that the movie is as tense as it is given that, because usually there's a lot of backstory, you get invested emotionally in characters, but it feels to me like this is a real genre exercise for David. He wanted to see how little you can know about characters and still get invested in them.
I think you're right. It was definitely a genre exercise for him. He wanted to do a mishmash, an explosive genre of two things, right? It's kind of the war movie Hurt Locker meets a kind of classic 70s heist movie. And again, it goes back to the hardboiled thing. I think he just wanted it to be hardboiled. Don't explain the characters too much. And I agreed. I was always trying to strip back, because in the process, there's naturally people go, oh, but well, you know, do you need to say, explain more about that character? And I think ultimately a film like this kind of is supposed to be about just the experience. And then the payoff at the end, you don't need to have every detail kind of spelled out for you.
Yeah, no, I really like that about it. And it also, I'm just fascinated by the idea that, I mean, you barely speak for the first, I think, the first 30, 40 minutes of the movie. So is that something that you're doing as well? Are you stripping back? Are you literally taking lines of dialogue out of the script like Eastwood used to do or Mel Gibson used to do back in the day?
Yeah, I mean, and with David, to be honest, we just, I think the, you know, I tried making him a little bit more, because I wanted him, once we get to know him, to have a roguish kind of quickfire quality. And I think, in a way, I tried that at the beginning, but it made the character lose a bit of power, really. So the idea was to bring it back to very little, and all the guys in the crew really just kind of communicating in very stripped back ways, so you know very little about them. But then the way it's shot as well, David likes big fat close-ups. I think he likes to be thinking, which I actually like too. I like them as an actor, and I like them cinematically. I like watching them, because what is great about screen is the ability to come in on someone's eyes and read into their thoughts, or have the audience project their own assumptions onto the character. That's what's great about screen. So anyway, you know, using that kind of filmmaking allows you into these characters a little bit, but you're removed enough because you don't know a lot about them.
How in control are you as an actor in terms of a close-up? So you're acting, you're in the moment, you're going to be responding to your scene partner or partners. How much control do you have over your facial expressions? How much control do you have over where your eyes go, over the way your lips may move or your nose may move? You know, those little tells, the little signifiers that give things away.
None, because I think as soon as you start thinking that, you're not. You know, in a way, when I first started working, the biggest thing I found, the most useful as an actor, is to be able to look in someone's eyes and just be listening and in the moment. And that is the most important thing, if you know what I mean. So if you're at a point where you're thinking consciously about what your face is doing, then that isn't reality and it's not naturalism, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I guess my point is that, no, I mean, I think some actors can do that and can do it successfully, but to me, I can't think about any of that because it feels self-conscious.
You like to surprise yourself as well, or I just be surprised in the moment.
Like me and you talking, if I'm looking at you.
But there's a tightly scripted Theo.
But there's no part of me that's thinking about how I look, because as soon as you do that, you are removed from naturalism and reality in a way.
Is that something that your journey as an actor, is that something that has always been there for you, you know, starting out back in the day?
No, I definitely had to learn that. I mean, I love film. I always watched films with big family, lots of kids. My brother did film. He was the eldest of five. He did film at UCSD, and we used to make films together, and he used to show me... that sounds kind of... snuff movies. No.
It's plausible deniability. They're not snuff movies. Yeah. That's good.
but as a... anyway, I was very interested in... But then I went to... I did a lot of theatre, and then I went to the Old Vic, where it's all about stagecraft and Jacobean. It's all about how you project your voice, it's about resonance, all those kind of things, which was interesting. And it's about iambic pentameter and a lot of that stuff. But when I came to, you know, being actually trying to get work, it was a quite quick learning curve, because obviously it is a very different skill set. And I had to adjust, definitely. I remember doing... I think my very first audition was for a character in Thor, like the first Thor.
Oh, right, okay.
And I remember I was just like smashing it out there, like I was on stage, and they're like, I think you want to bring that down a little bit. I see, okay, gotcha. but it's a constant learning experience, you know. I don't think it's something you ever, like, you know, you think you've mastered it, and then you start the next job, and you go, oh, no, I haven't, you know. It's an evolution, and I think that's how all actors should be.
Because, absolutely.
You know, I think...
You just stagnate otherwise, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when was the last time you auditioned? I imagine it was quite some time ago.
It's a good question. I don't know.
If you have to think, that usually means it was quite a while ago.
Maybe the White Lotus, I think.
White Lotus?
Yeah. What about you?
25 years ago for a theater production of amateur theater production of The Crucible.
The Crucible. Yes. Oh, nice. Where was that?
University.
What university?
York St. John's. Yeah.
What were you studying?
Film and TV.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're here legit.
Yeah, tangentially, I've ended up in the around the industry. But yeah. I didn't get the role I was going for. I imagine you got the role
but I often didn't. You know?
Yeah.
I remember in at the Old Vic, they had a... Romeo and Juliet, and I was like, Tybalt or something. And they're like, you're going to be Peter the maid. I know, I was very cross.
But then you threw yourself into that role with gusto.
I did. Yeah. Fully method it up.
That's the way to go. You mentioned The White Lotus. I mean, that obviously had a huge impact on your career, I'm guessing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, great writing, freedom in, he trusts his actors once he's cast them.
This is Mike White, yeah.
Mike White, yeah. To kind of experiment and go big or small, which I think is a really good environment. Trust in, once you've, because in a way, I've heard this, lots of directors say, in a way, you get the casting right, then you should kind of let it roll. I think if you don't, then actors start second guessing, and performances lack naturalism, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So great writing with the ability for a bit of freedom is the best, you know, for any actor, really. That's what Mike does.
They've just announced a cast for season 4.
Ooh.
Season 3 was last year, of course. Do you watch on with a sense of, I'd quite like to be?
No.
Are you happy that your experience was done?
No, honestly, I don't. I enjoy watching the third season. I think they're designed in a way to have new people and new energy injected into them. And, you know, I'm a little bit of a psychopath in that way. Like, generally, once something is over, whatever that thing may be, I'm kind of moving forward, which my wife often tells me off for.
Unless it's a South African accent, in which case it's always in the pocket.
Around, only because it's useful.
In what circumstances is it useful?
I don't know. It's funny. My wife tells me off because somehow, I don't know why, but like in so in public situations, if something's happening and I want to call it out, for some reason I'll put an Irish accent on because I think it's more disarming than an English accent.
Oh, it's very charming.
Do you know what I mean? Like an English accent, you're like, excuse me. Whereas an Irish accent, I think you get away with more. But she's like, what the fuck are you doing? Please stop doing that. It's embarrassing to me.
How specific is your Irish accent, Theo?
I'm not going to do it because my wife, if she hears this podcast, will crucify me. But no, I had to do it once for a film with Jim Sheridan. And it was terrifying because it was years ago. It was 10 years ago. But yeah. I remember going to the read-through and me and Rooney Mara were the only, you know, non-Irish. And there's a big table room full of Irish people. And then suddenly you're trying to do in front of proper Irish people. I found it pretty hard, let's say.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. I've got to let you go. But I just want to ask one last question. I love The Monkey.
Oh, thanks.
And you mentioned table reads there. And what was your table read for that? And what was that like, given that you were playing two very, very different roles?
Good question about the table read. There wasn't actually.
Oz doesn't strike me as a table read guy.
No, he's not. And I like him a lot. We actually developed something together during lockdown. Something else. So we'd known each other, and then he was talking. He was going to do The Monkey, and I was obviously, you know, very up for it because I know how talented he is. I'd been watching him since Blackcoat's Daughter. But I think originally there were going to be two different characters, but me and Oz were like, I think it'd be interesting if they were familial and they were basically twins. So I kind of loved it because the fun of that movie was to be able to play polar opposites. You know, you get a kind of introverted, sarcastic, and quite controlled person mixed with a kind of maniac. And Oz was like Mike in the way he can kind of, you can swing, and he lets you, you know, because I always heard that thing about Al Pacino, right? He says, I'm going to butcher the quote, but he said something about, you know, when I go for it, it's like an opera singer, right? Sometimes I go for it and I hit the note and it's great. And sometimes I go for the note and it cracks. So like, i.e. the ability to like try things is important, I think, because otherwise it becomes an exercise in like looking sexy and saying stuff in a croaky voice.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that. Yeah. Absolutely. On that note, Theo James, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, sir.
All right, that was Theo James. And Fuse, with a Z, is out in cinemas with an S from Friday, April 3rd. Okay, now we've lit the fuse on the show. Who's ready for some trash? And who better to talk trash than a man dubbed affectionately the Pope of Trash? Yes, it's John Waters, the legendary American director of low-budget, low-taste classics, two of which, Pink Flamingos and Multiple Maniacs, both of which star Waters' great friend and muse Divine, are playing at a new season at the BFI South Bank in London entitled, yes, you've guessed it, Trash, subtitled The Wildest Films You've Ever Seen. It's on right now and it runs until the 30th of April. And as well as films by Waters, it features screens of cult films from the likes of Herschel Gordon Lewis, Ed Wood and Russ Meyer, as well as special intros, and on Friday, April 10th, a cabaret evening with Mink Stole and Peaches Christ. Now, Waters himself was kind enough to take time out from his busy schedule to jump onto Zoom this week to talk trash to the Empire podcast with our very own Jamie Graham. Here it is. Enjoy.
So, Mr. John Waters, welcome to the Empire podcast. A delight to have you today.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all, not at all. So I want to start by asking, because trash cinema, I mean, there's so much that can be said about it, but what does it mean to you? If you're describing it to the listeners out there who may not be familiar with trash cinema, what are the characteristics? What are the aesthetics? What can you tell us about it?
I think trash cinema really became a term when sexploitation and exploitation films met art films together, and they they made a joke about censorship and what you could get away with. And a new genre was born from this, with movies that were incredibly original, that were not always a hit when they first came out, but have been treasured by a few. And luckily, new people learn about them every year.
Yeah, very much so. And I'm sure the BFI season, many more people will learn about them. Now, you started in the 60s. You did several short films and you made Mondo Trash Show in 1969. But trash cinema goes way back, doesn't it? It goes back to the 1930s. So when you were growing up, did you have influences? Did you have particular films or filmmakers you looked up to?
Certainly not from the 30s. And I don't think you could call those films trash. That was a different thing, because then it was, I don't know, I it was breaking the Hays Code and all that kind of stuff. That's a whole different thing, I think. These films were started to compete. The Hollywood system could not show certain things. And these films played with that and made fun of that and snuck things in. I mean, George and Mike Kuchar's brother, Sins of the Flesh of Paws, was one of the first underground movies I ever saw. And it was a huge influence on me. It took Douglas Sirk and put him together with a shot of a turd and a toilet. Nobody had ever done that before. And even Doris Wishman, whose film on here, Another Day, Another Man, I don't think even I have ever seen this one. But she was an outsider artist, really, I think. She was a totally, like a Jewish grandmother who made nudie exploitation films with titles like Nude on the Moon. Is there a better title than that ever?
I don't think so, no. That is absolutely marvelous. Now, I know for a fact, I see your list at the end of every year. You do a top 10 films list, and you have all kinds of cinema on there. You like highbrow cinema, art cinema, trash cinema, everything's there. Now, do you feel you need to understand the rules of kind of mainstream cinema and even highbrow art cinema in order to break the rules and subvert the rules in trash cinema?
Well, I always said that to use bad taste and change people's opinion, you'd have to know the rules of good taste.
Right.
I think my top 10 is usually just no middle brow. You know, I love Final Destination Part 2, and I loved Eddington. One was in a crazy art movie that goes off the rails in a beautiful way. And yep. Final Destination was the fourth part of an exploitation series of movies that is absolutely done to perfection. So yeah. I believe that lowbrow can be high art if it's done well.
Yeah, very much so. Now, I want to talk about Multiple Maniacs, which was your second movie in 1970. Now, this film, it's got cop killing. It's got a sex act with rosary beads. It's got Divine being sexually assaulted by a giant lobster. Now, I just wonder, do you think it's kind of now even more scandalous than it was then, because we now live in such a PC world?
Yes, I think Pink Flamingos definitely is. You can't say happy birthday, fatso anymore. There's lines in there. I always said you can say the F word on American network television, but you can't say fat on public TV.
Very true.
So yeah. Things have changed. Multiple Maniacs was made in an homage kind of to Herschel Gordon Lewis, who's also in this series. He made a movie called 2000 Maniacs.
Yeah.
And I just love the title. It is a movie that was made to offend hippies for a hippie audience, which is, I've always done, made fun of whatever political correctness was. At this time, this is making fun of hippie correctness. It was the peace and love years. And we had a movie that ludicrously, worshipped crazy violence, but it was a comedy. That's the whole thing. And even the rosary job, the most sacrilegious thing. I was raised Catholic, and I'm always thinking of Buñuel and all the other people that have used Catholic scenes to try to get it out of your system. It's impossible. Even the rosary job still made me feel glad I was Catholic, because sex will always be dirty.
Yeah, very much so. And then Pink Flamingos, which is obviously a part of this season. I mean, it's infamously got the singing anus. It's got Divine eating dog turd. It was banned in certain territories. Mainstream critics, a lot of them, dismissed it. But audiences really took to it. It did really well. Were you surprised by the success of it in that way?
I was not surprised at success. The world premiere was in Baltimore. I rented a university hall. We had three shows for three nights, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8, 10, and midnight. Every show was sold out, and the audience went insane. I knew that even if you hated the movie, you had to talk about it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was not surprised it was a hit. I was thrilled. I never knew it would play 10 years at midnight in one cinema. I never knew I'd still be talking about it half a century later or whatever, how many years it's been. But still, I'm proud of that. And yes, Pink Flamingos is even worse today than it was then. However, it got named by the American government as a great American film.
Yep.
Variety, who gave it the meanest review ever, wrote a kind of apology and then picked it as one of the best 100 film comedies ever, up there with Charlie Chaplin and the Marx Brothers. So I feel just delighted about it all. I don't want revenge. The bad review Variety gave me helped me more than this new good thing in a way. It was nice to get the new good thing, but the negative reviews at the time I built a career off of.
I was going to say that its reputation has only grown over the years. I think now, along with Plan 9 from Outer Space by Ed Wood, it's probably regarded as a kind of Citizen Kane of trash, isn't it?
Well, yes, maybe, and I'm compliment and thank you, but I think the movies are very, very different. I don't think Ed Wood ever made any movie to be funny. He never made anything to be so bad it was good. He was trying the best he could. Pink Flamingos, I knew what I was doing. I knew that I was making fun of exploitations and censorship and everything. Ed Wood was another almost outsider artist that was driven and made these movies outside the system. But I don't think he ever used the word camp or thought they were.
Yeah, very much.
That's why they're so good. If you try to be campy, it doesn't work. The real meaning of camp, a word I never use anymore, is basically so bad it's good without the knowledge. And you can't say it later, like Showgirls, the director says now he made it to be funny. I don't believe him. That's why it's so good.
Yeah. I think you're right on that one. So something we need to touch upon is there's a very kind of serious intent to a lot of trash cinema that beneath the shock tactics, beneath the rough and ready aesthetics, it can be political, it can be transgressive, it subverts with ideas of gender and sexuality. I mean, how important is all of that side of it?
Well, I think sometimes you can read a little too much in it. Russ Meyer was trying to make money. He didn't give a crap about feminist politics at the time, even though he made a classic of it.
Yeah,
I think you can read too much into it. Some of these films were made totally just to make money, and it didn't matter. They had an accidental masterpiece. I mean, you look at Blood Feast. It's hardly a work of art, but it is the first movie where they distributed vomit bags. It is one of the most hilarious, crazy movies. I remember seeing it at the drive-in. And in the old days at the drive-in in America, whenever you saw tits or gore, you honked your horn. So this movie, the horns were honking through the whole movie.
How old were you when you first saw movies like Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Feast?
Probably, well, I don't remember. I got my license at 16, and the first place I went is the drive-in.
Right.
So it was certainly around those times. What year did Blood Feast come out? I can't remember.
Early 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I was in high school then. So during those years, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And now in America, the drive-ins that are left are family-friendly. They don't show R-rated movies. They have car shows and flea markets. When I was young, the drive-ins were the bottom layer of exploitation films. They could show the worst. And they were open even in the winter. And that's when they showed the most extreme movies of all. Dusk to Dawn, Gore Night. And you'd had heaters in the car that caught on fire and stuff. It was a great experience.
That's how it should be, the good old days.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't agree with that. I think it's more great today that the BFI is, I don't have to bring a heater with me to see these movies.
That's true.
Well, maybe. I know you like it cold in London. But I think that it's better today. It's better that these films are easier to see and everybody can see them. And I think it's way better than it was then.
So that's interesting, because obviously some of your movies are now on Criterion. BFI is doing a wonderful trash season. You've had Pink Flamingos has been preserved in the National Film Registry. Do you like the fact that you've been kind of ordained with this respectability now or being accepted? Or does
I've said a lot in the press, I feel so respectable I could puke. But I mean that. I'm glad this has happened, certainly. I don't mean it with any irony. I'm honored that these things happen. It is astounding to me. I try to picture when they had that meeting to film registry to pick Pink Flamingos, what was the scene? What was the screening? Was it when the singing asshole happened? They said, this is it. Let's give this American. I'm trying to imagine what caused that. What was that screening like? Because I remember when we got arrested for the movie in obscenity trials, we pled guilty because what would happen is, at midnight, that movie is not obscene. It's joyous. Everybody in the audience is laughing. At 8 a.m. in a courtroom with 12 jurors sitting there watching the singing asshole, it is obscene. It is. There's no saying it isn't. It's about context and audience expectations. And at the British Film Institute, they can never be obscene.
Yeah. Good point. Now, I want to know, John, like, obviously in your career, you kind of inched towards the mainstream as you went on, that movies like Hairspray and Serial Mom and Pecker, they're a lot more kind of polished and technically adept than your early work. Do you think it's possible to have well-made trash?
Yes, definitely. I think Serial Mom is my best movie that I ever made. Yeah. And I had the most money and Kathleen Turner and everything. I always wanted my movies to look good. That's just as good as I could make them at the time with my knowledge and my budget. So you forget, when we made Pink Flamingos, we had $10,000. I think I got $2,000 more. It was $12,000. That was big budget to us because we had $5,000 to make Multiple Maniacs. So each time it grew, and the Hollywood thing, only once did all of Hollywood want to make a movie with me, and that was after Hairspray came out. Yeah. So Crybaby, they were all fighting to do it and everything, and it was not a hit when it came out. It certainly, over the years, has found a great audience and even become a Broadway play that failed, even though it did well in London recently.
Oh, that's great. And just finally, John, because our time is up, but I want to ask you, you've been called many things over the years. You've been called the Pope of Trash, the Prince of Puke, the Sultan of Sleaze. Do you have a particular favorite nickname?
Well, the Anal Ambassador made me laugh.
That's impossible to beat, isn't it?
All those titles were given to me favorably. None of them were used against me. I've gotten plenty of bad reviews, but all those titles were meant favorably at the time.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Well, John, I know you're a busy man, so thank you so much for your time today. That was an absolute delight.
Okay, that was the legendary John Waters talking to Jamie Graham about Trash, the wildest films you've ever seen, which is now playing at the BFI South Bank in London. For more information and to book tickets, go to whatson.bfi.org.uk. That is whatson, whatson, .bfi.org.uk. Okay, one last interview this week, and it is an extended excerpt from our spoiler special interview with Matt Bettinelli Open and Tyler Gillette, the directors of Ready or Not, Here I Come, which is in cinemas now. It's the extremely fun sequel to their extremely fun 2019 comedy horror, Ready or Not, and the duo came into the pod booth recently for a near hour-long deep dive with me into the film's various twists and turns. That is up now in full on our spoiler special feed, along with Team Empire's discussion of the film and over 500 other spoiler specials. Here you're going to get a 15 to 20 minute excerpt from it, which may well wet your whistle for the full thing. I will say, obviously, this is a spoiler special, so you'd best listen to this only if you've seen Ready or Not, Here I Come. And there is strong language, the strongest, in fact, from the off, which for once, I'm not going to bleep. Fair warning. Hopefully, you'll understand why if you've seen the film. Okay, ready or not? Here it comes. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on this Ready or Not, Here I Come. I'm not going to say the two guys. That's entirely...
We support that decision.
Yes.
All respect to you, Chris.
That's what the title card at the end says. Ready or Not, Here I Come. Spoiler special by the film's directors, Tyler Gillette and Matt Bettinelli. Open. How the devil are you both?
Oh, I just love hearing the last names pronounced correctly.
Yeah, that's like a first.
Thank you. Bang and start.
Good to be here.
I was up all night trying to get it right. I did think at one point about starting this interview off with the somewhat contentious. Now, this I didn't want to offend you guys right from the off.
Oh, we're like, but I was coming in hot.
I was toying with going, "Hi, cunt." And then finishing bye, off with bye, cunt, at the end. But you know what? I don't want to offend you guys. You're nice people.
I don't think we can be offended. I don't think that's possible anymore.
That is a great moment in the movie. Where did that come from? Was that in the script?
Oh, man.
I can't remember.
No, it was a prep evolution.
Yeah, but...
Because we were that specific moment... It was one of the things that we were knocking around so many different versions of when we were barreling towards photography start. There was this conversation about the weapons and like what's the most interesting, what's the most sort of cinematic. How do we give everybody an object, a hand prop that's like very distinct to their personality and very memorable? And the original...
it was a bow and
arrow. Francesca originally had a bow and arrow, which was a gift from Becky Ladomas, Alex's mom, her almost mother-in-law.
Yeah.
And it just felt like at that point in the movie, there had been so many like near misses, you know, where Grace like just barely escapes a gunshot and barely escapes, you know. So we were just rattle testing everything. And like, we knew that dad, Ignacio, has the sniper rifle. And we knew that
Felipe
has the two, you know, gold plated automatic Berettas.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, cool. Like, so this family, they signed their deal in the 80s, like they're more militarized.
Yeah, they're newer families.
So if we're following that train of thought, like what's the most ridiculous, what's the hardest pivot out of that emotional Grace faith scene where the shit, like the highest sort of the peak of drama between the sisters, what is the sharpest fucking turn we can make?
What is the dumbest thing we could do next?
How can we immediately resignal the tone? And it was, I don't remember, it was like, we both sort of had the idea. It was like we saw the rocket launcher idea in each other's eyes. And it was like the quickest game of yes and. I was like, I mean, what if it's a, and you're like,
a rocket launcher?
And I was like, right. And then, I mean, and you're like, she shoots it and it goes, I mean, it was
And then we, you know, we asked the writers who were like, no. And then as soon as they saw it, we sent them the dailies and they're like, oh, yes. I'm so glad you guys did that. It was very fun, which is how it always works.
It was
we just challenge each other until we all like something.
But the studio was also like, guys, it might be too much. We might be jumping the shark. And we were like, well, look, we're gonna play it as dry and as grounded as everything in the movie. Like, it'll be...
But we did have to get a safety. They made us get a safety.
We shot a safety with no intention of like ever really, you know, using it.
What was the safety?
She just ran at her. She just opens the door, high cunt, and then like chases, you know.
Oh, okay.
Runs into the what becomes the sort of
pepper spray bee.
No bye cunt. Yeah. Yeah. It's an incomplete thought. Yeah. That's the origin of the rocket launcher, just the height of ridiculousness.
I don't think the C word's been said quite so much in one of our spoiler specials. We just did one for Pixar's Hoppers, and there were loads on that. But I think you've just about pipped it to the post. So you know, there's so much to talk about this movie. I mean, that started at the very beginning in terms of the idea that Grace, along with Faith this time, of course, is forced to do another round of hide and seek during the development phase. Because I know this movie came around for you guys fairly quickly after Abigail. It wasn't initially on your docket. How did you toy with other games? Did you toy with other iterations of this? And when did you ultimately come down on another deadly game of hide and seek?
That was there for a very long time. I think the basic idea had been around, you know, honestly, very shortly after the original movie, the idea of like the council and the new game, and it got tweaked and refined over time.
I think got distilled and simplified.
Yeah,
and there was like a moment where we didn't have the specific language of hide and seek.
We wanted to make sure that it wasn't too much just the same thing again. And then when we were like getting into it, though, we were like, okay, it maybe it's best if the game is the same, but we do that because That's what the Laodomases did. And so the other families can have their own point of view on how stupid this is. That's like baby shit is what Ignacio says.
And yeah, yeah.
So we tried to figure out a way, you know, with the writers to figure out how to get it to like fit in this new movie without just being like, we're doing the same thing again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But obviously amping the stakes. I mean, the stakes of this game
are huge. And then letting
the
movie and the characters around it be what makes it new and exciting.
Yeah. And building the mythology of it as well, because you really build it out.
God bless Elijah Wood.
Yeah. And the families are, you know, they're in the first movie, there's infighting, obviously, but they're all working towards the same goal, some more successfully, you know, than others. Certain people, obviously, they all have a different kind of moral point of view on it, but they're all working to capture grace and, to preserve the family line. And in this movie, you know, we have our villains are also fighting each other, which is the big sort of unique ingredient, the new engine in the hunt, in the sort of plot mythology of this story.
Tell me about coming up with each of the families. Did you have more families at one point? How did you decide different characteristics?
I'm not sure it was more families. There were more characters in each family in the early drafts.
Yeah, that was a long evolution. The families changed. Like where they were from,
the sources
how many
of their
there
wealth,
were, and it really
the different games that they sort of had.
Yeah, there was a lot of exploration over the years in that. And I think at the end of the day, it really came down to when we were in pre-production, and it was like, okay, what is the size of the story we're telling?
What can
and
we
then
achieve?
Let's make sure every character is specific and unique and get rid of everybody else that we don't need. So it kind of just got distilled in, you know, the few months before we started shooting.
But there was one concept that I think we all liked, and it just ended up on the... in the trash bin. Is there was a version, I don't remember, I think it was, there was a scene where in one of the drafts where Grace finds herself in like the penthouse of the resort. And in that penthouse, there were display cases that had versions of every family on the council's choosing box, you know, the card that hide and seek pops out of in the first movie. Oh, that was always a cool idea, but it was just one of those things that felt like,
why would the Danforths have it?
Why would the Danforths have it? And why are we building this very elaborate, you know, very specific, very nuanced thing when we weren't really doing anything? You know, it wasn't really in service. It wasn't in service of the story because you'd already met the families, and it felt like something like an interesting texture that ultimately was not additive. But
you can see
was,
the
yeah you
in
can
the
see
Chesters in the Cronenberg scene, that family, the Danforth's choosing box is on the table next to him. We don't shine a light on it, but yeah, it is visible.
Yeah, amazing. With some poker chips on top.
Yeah.
Cronenberg is fantastic in this film. I mean, he's not in it a lot, but he makes an impact. I love that guy. You talk about upping the stakes of this, because ultimately, at the end of the day, Grace ends up playing for essentially to rule the world.
Right.
Which is a hell of a thing. I love that gag in the opening Cronenberg scene where it's like he orders a ceasefire and seconds later it happens. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's been the most surprising laugh for us. Hearing audiences respond to that that's an unexpected. There's always like a handful of those, right, where you get a response that is bigger than you expect, and that's one that I think we've always thought is really like a quiet laugh, but people really
it's a big laugh.
That's a big laugh, which is great.
What's the laugh that you thought would really hit home? What's the laugh that you expected to hit big?
I mean, I think the cut to Samara boxing air.
Yeah, swinging.
Swinging and nothing. I think that's like, that was sort of one of those like almost cheap gags.
She's where you're like, cop this right is... now. Yeah, yeah, it's like such a trope. There's such a,
we're really doing this, but man, it's funny every time.
I also love, I mean, I want to talk about specific things, but we're jumping around for a second, but I also love whenever Grace and Faith use the industrial washer.
To boil.
We have a twice as long version of that is
Virage
hilarious. But
it's amazing. Just the looks they exchange, kind of going, can you believe that this is happening? Yeah. What the fuck are we
doing?
Yeah,
that it's actually, it's real. It becomes like, oh, we're actually...
Yeah, it's like we're badass, and all of a sudden, this is terrible.
Oh, no, he's...
Yeah.
It's really...
It's one of the things that, I mean, we talked about it a lot with Sam and Catherine, like, is that, you know, especially with Sam, where she's not a superhero.
Yeah.
And she's also not bloodthirsty. You know what I mean?
Totally.
She's not like out just killing everybody she can. Like the only person she really kills before the end, or, you know, it's a
Yeah, Francesca,
when she has a weapon. It's like, we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just all of a sudden this just becomes kind of silly bloodlust.
Yeah. So something like that. Absolutely.
Yeah, so when they have to watch him die and they're like, oh shit, he's
I mean,
he's
sitting
the reality of it. Yeah. It doesn't go as quick as they think.
Absolutely. In terms of building out the mythology and the rules of the game, how long did that take you guys and the writers to hit upon things? And were there things that you didn't quite make the cut? There's little wrinkles, for example, like you can't kill fellow competitors. When did you hit upon that idea? Because
that was pretty early.
That was early. Yeah. I feel like there were, it's like everything where it's like there's a lot of ideas that get put in and then they get kind of taken out. And then the ones that you realize you're missing get put back in. But it was even down to, Elijah really holds that all together. His performance is so good there, because we were all going into that a little concerned. Even when we asked Elijah to be in the movie, it was like, this character has like 10 pages of exposition.
Yeah.
But we think you could be really, really special and bring something cool to that.
Yeah.
And make it actually really entertaining, which he does. But I mean, that scene got even the rules and the way they were laid out, even when we were in the edit, we were kind of moving things around to make sure that it could flow as naturally as possible.
Yeah, because a lot is sort of set up and it's fun and it's information. And then, but you want to make sure that you're ingesting it, right? And that people are really tracking it, because it's what, 20 minutes, 25 minutes down the line, all those rules start to have a real impact on the story, right? Start to pay off. The families start, injuring each other, and there are a couple close calls, and then, it's Chen Xing kills Ignacio, and that's the first instance of, oh fuck, the thing that we learned about, in that long monologue, we now are seeing the very real consequences of it.
It's also the leaning, whereas in the first movie, it's like, you got to play hide and seek, go. That's the entire thing. Mm-hmm. In this one, we had a lot of fun leaning into the idea of like, oh my God, there's so much bureaucracy and just bullshit and like just that you have to like wade through. There's this giant book of rules.
It's mundane.
It's like the terms and conditions that we all sign all the time. It's like this, just so much stuff. And there was something that was like kind of delicious about that.
I mean, it really is. I mean, you're down to when Ignacio dies for the first time, and you have suddenly everyone realizes what that means.
Right, exactly.
And the bit where Elijah ducks behind the podium. I mean, talk about big laughs. That's going to get them as well.
Yeah, but that's one of my favorite little scenes. That from that death through, that end of, it's just such a lovely, weird little moment.
Did you always have people dying in the order that they die in? Nestor Carbonell's Ignacio is the first person to kind of go at the hands of another family.
Yeah, I feel like we did. I feel like Guy and Ryan did a great job of like that. They created a great kind of foundation for the way that the plot unfolds, so that when we actually got into pre-production, there was like a set piece that was X, but we couldn't do that because of production reasons. So let's figure out how to make it work over here instead. And so there was a lot of that, but the big ideas and placements of things.
It's pretty set.
Pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a lot more room, once Catherine got put in the mix, because the sister wasn't in the script for a really long time.
Mm.
Once her character got put in, the foundation was really strong. So we could really build on the character stuff on top of it.
So when I spoke to you guys and Samara for the regular podcast, you said that it was on Abigail that you first had the idea of Catherine as Faith. So the sister wasn't in the script even at that point?
No, in the early drafts, it was a friend. It was a police officer. It was the daughter of one of the families.
So there was someone else.
We knew that there needed to be so many versions. Yeah, a core emotional relationship in the story, but it felt like, in all of the versions, it felt like the dynamic between those two characters, there wasn't enough implied backstory that you just like wanted them to spend time together. So in all of those versions, and we like pretty fully developed all of them.
Oh, all of them, yeah.
Grace ends up separate from that character, and it just starts to feel like the first movie, right? Like there's an anchor character that you're sort of cutting away to that just is killing the killing the tension in what Grace is attempting to achieve. And when it became a sister, it felt like it was just such a cheat code, right? There's so much implied in what could have gone wrong and what that relationship might be, because it's family, and not for nothing. That's the theme, right? It's sort of tracking the theme of the first movie, you know, family into this one in a way that made a lot of sense in sort of an inverse way, right? Grace is marrying into a family that ultimately doesn't want her. And in this movie, the family that she doesn't want, it comes back into her life and she has to learn to accept it and sort of, you know, rekindle that relationship.
None of which you had in the first movie, right? I mean, how much backstory do you have about...
No,
about
there Grace is. There is. It's in both movies, but especially in the first movie, we were... Like, one of the fun magic tricks of the movie is that so much is filled in by your imagination. Yeah. I mean, there's like one line that Grace has about growing up in an orphanage and wanting a family. That's it. And you fill in all the blanks. And then Samara brings so much to that character. And we wanted to kind of stick to that with this, where it wasn't, you know, in a more traditional movie, you might have bigger scenes about all of the past history stuff. In this, it's like 1.5 scenes under duress. And it's all implied. And there's something about that that just helps you kind of keep the pace up. But we also wanted to be really conscious of, like Tyler was just saying, if the first movie is like an anti-love story, this is a love story. Mm. And there is like a little bit of a rom-com structure to it. And we wanted to make sure that we were taking the time to hit those sister moments and really like get to know them a little bit without going too much into Remember When territory.
Which is tricky as well, because they're being pursued for their lives in every single scene.
I think that was the hardest thing to calibrate is those gear shifts, because, you know, for us, that relationship is the reason why any of it matters, right? Otherwise, it's just sort of plot. And knowing how and calibrating how and when to downshift and to be in those scenes long enough that it feels like they have real weight, and to also not have it just be under such duress that it's not believable that they would be unpacking it. So it's, you know, you have to sort of give the audience permission to sit in those moments and to not necessarily feel the immediacy of like the threat at all times, because we want to focus your attention on those two characters,
right?
And what they're going through. And it was important to preserve that. And those scenes, all they were long, they got shorter. We attacked those. A lot of time was spent making sure that those were as lean as possible, so that, you know, we're certainly aware that like we're kind of letting our foot off the gas a little bit there, but we hope that what we are doing is actually accelerating something more interesting, right? It's the sort of emotional heart of the movie where we're actually upshifting stuff in those scenes.
All right, that was Tyler Gillette and Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin talking about Ready or Not, Here I Come, which is in cinemas now. And if you haven't seen it already, why did you just listen to that? But if you haven't seen it already, it is a ton of bloody fun. And if you do want to hear the rest of that interview and Team Empire's take, and also our spoiler special for Project Hail Mary with Lord and Miller, and Daredevil Born Again Season 2 weekly spoilers, and much, much more, go to EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com to sign up for just £3.49 a month. That's right, EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com. It's a brand new URL, which is hopefully easy to remember. And on that note, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. We'll be back next week with more cracking cinematic chats. Until then, the regular pod featuring Fuse's Aaron Taylor-Johnson and David McKenzie will be up from Friday, April 3rd, and is a belter as we dive into Easter-themed questions, trailers galore, and review the drama, Fuse, the Super Mario Galaxy movie, and Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. All right, that's enough for me. I'm not off to rob a bank. Wink, wink, if you catch my drift. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have left that bit in there. Damn it. Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.